I think there are two big buckets of discussion on this scenario. There's the weather and how to navigate the weather just to get to Nashville. And then there's your obligations to your client, both as understanding the airplane and just getting them back home. And the two of them are mixed together here. And the pilot is definitely launching so that they can get experience, hopefully without undue risk, either for themselves or the client, and to make some progress towards Nashville so they can get their client home. So Elaine, if I were to take getting experience in the airplane and the pressure of the return trip off the table, if you were just trying to get to Nashville in an SR-20 by the end of the day, would you still go with choice four? Or would you just sit back and wait for a while for this weather to pass through, right? How daunting is this weather, just the weather in itself, in other words?
If I had all day to get there, I would probably wait until both the precipitation band had passed to allow a more direct flight, as well as that band of turbulence that might be following afterwards, according to the air mets. I certainly would not want to launch, realize that I really couldn't have made the flight and have to turn back if I had to tell the person waiting for me that I'm not even going to make it that day. So that does change a little bit of the decision making and take some of the pressure off as well.
Yeah, so in other words, this weather isn't totally benign. If you could avoid this, you would avoid it. But we're going to put right on the table here that there's some real world pressure pushing this pilot in a particular direction. And that's enough to tip the scale, if you will, on this weather. But it's not totally daunting, in your opinion, to take that route and kind of go through. And Catherine, you're on the same boat. I'm going to ask you the same question. If you were just going to Nashville, and you know this area well, if you were just going to Nashville for the day, would you just wait this out? You'd be like, yeah, I'm going to start making my way. And I'll add in there, too, come evening, fog and other things are predicted in the forecast discussion to come in. So there is a little bit of pressure to get there, at least before the sun goes down. How much is succumbing to the pressure? How much is the weather itself?
I would probably go ahead and do it either way. So okay. To me, that's, that pressure isn't, a big element of my thought process.
And let me stay with you for a moment, Catherine. If you were making this flight, are you anticipating, probably that gap where the widest section, that's my plan to shoot through that gap right there?
That would be my initial plan. I would take off and just monitor the weather. I'd also be monitoring how recent my weather is. Mm-hmm. And, my out is going to be fly considerably west if I need to. But if there's a nice gap in there, I'd probably go ahead and take it.
Right. So you're basically on a five track, looking to your right, like, yep, that's the spot. Now I'm a four and I'm committing.
When I flew here a couple of days ago, I did something very similar.
Right. Does that count for you as well, Tom? You're a 4/5. Did I just sort of sum that up? Can you expand and tell me what's your plan and why you're kind of having a foot in both camps?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Pretty much what Catherine said. I mean, I think I'd go ahead and go. I wouldn't necessarily wait for it to pass. So I would take off and be just kind of looking to, kind of off the right wing there. And when things look like there's an opportunity to go more northerly and head up toward Nashville, I'd be taking that. And if I have to go all the way to the west around it, it's like, well, okay, I'm building time.
You're definitely building time because you're in a 20, not a 22.
Right.
You're in an older 20, so we're at 145 knot airplane,
right,
realistically,
right
here. And yep, you're looking at 40 knots on the nose. You're at like,
yep,
old 172 speeds.
Yeah.
That's going to be you're going to be really, really hoping for that turn to the,
yep,
right.
Yep. I am, but I'm okay with that. I've got the fuel. The client's paying for the fuel, right?
Yep. Yep. So. Client's paying for the fuel, paying for your time. So
yeah. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Exactly. John and Bruce, I'll start with John. You're not shooting for the gap. You're just going to keep going west until you can cut around the backside of the worst of this stuff and then go to Nashville that way. John.
As opposed to a 4/5, I'd be a 5/4.
Okay.
And because or multiple reasons. One, the 4 route looks good now, but an hour, hour and a half from now when you take off, that gap's not going to be there. Mm-hmm. It's going to widen, close up. It's something's going to happen because it's dynamic. Weather is dynamic. But the 1 and 2 route goes right over the top of Atlanta, and that's not happening. it's just not happening. There's 9 prior routes in ForeFlight that prior clearances have been issued, 9 separate routes. Every single one of them is over Atlanta or east. So they're routing all the traffic east. And you're probably going to wind up on more like the 3 route with the weather coming at you. Plus all the Atlanta traffic that's diverting and picking your way through an area like that with maybe some limits on deviations, because everybody's going to be wanting to go through the same spots and stuff. So my philosophy is you start safe and you chip away at it. Start with 5. And your escape plan shouldn't be your primary plan. That's your escape plan. So we start safe and then chip away at it as the situation develops.
And almost it sounds like get far enough west that the rooting around Atlanta can't throw you east of Atlanta.
Right, it's a
strong nod on
right,
that.
Right.
Let me stay with you for a second before I go to Bruce. How would you file that? I'm not asking for particular fixes in the research here, but what would you be shooting for given you're going to Nashville, given that the computer is looking at here to here over Atlanta, you're going east, and that's the last thing you want to do.
Right.
How are you going to stack the deck in your favor?
That's always a challenge with these. No matter what you file, the computer is going to spit out the pref route. Mm-hmm. And it may take some negotiation while you're getting your clearance, where they would have to do a manual amendment. If that airspace is in Atlanta, TRACON's airspace, so you'd be talking at least to an Atlanta TRACON controller for the route. And more than likely, they're going to say, well, take the filed route and work it out airborne. and you're going to have to do some negotiation somehow.
Right. And that was my follow-up on that is, are you negotiating on the ground before takeoff or in
you
this case?
You can try.
Are
you... It doesn't always work.
Yeah. Yeah. Bruce.
Well, I'm exactly with John on the basic overall philosophy. This is a 5/4, not a 4/5. I'm going west. And then if the wind is blowing the weather along the way and I see gaps or clear air, I'm going to chip away at that and head more north. Mm-hmm. To the question of the routing and how would I'd file... Well, I know my ultimate destination is Nashville, but if my plan is actually to do a 5-type routing, why not just file to an airport that's out that way anyway, get the correct routing, avoid all this discussion with ATC, and then once you see that it's better, either because I burned too much gas and I want to land and take a break, or ask for now, I've changed my destination, I want to go to Nashville. I make another point, too. This whole setup is talking about we're sort of focused on this new SR-20, or new to this pilot anyway. Mm-hmm. The real question to me is, this guy has experience flying big jets in the Air Force. The real issue here is, this is light GA, and Elaine alluded to it in her response. The real lesson here is, what do you do in a light piston single? It doesn't matter whether it's an SR, Bonanza, whatever. And that's the real lesson here. And yeah, you might have a few extra resources in a glass cockpit in a Cirrus versus something else. But the real issue is, how do I deal with this kind of weather situation in a light single? And I'm going around it until I'm sure I'm not going to get wedged in either by the weather or ATC or whatever.
Right. So you're just staying clear until the canyon is so wide, essentially, you're not going to be stuck in the box canyon.
And
where
I fly, I don't have as much experience with these types of systems as somebody like Catherine does, who flies in this area a lot. But I'm very skeptical. I see heavy precipitation mentioned here, but it's not convective. That's still convection. If it's heavy precipitation, there's some air going up and down to make that kind of precipitation. And so I personally, with my experience, I'd be saying, I'm seeing yellow and red. I'm staying away from that, even if there's no lightning, even if everybody, all the experts are saying it's probably not going to get convective. I want to stay clear of that.
Now, Doug, it sort of feels like trying to find the parking space. There are two philosophies. Oh, look, there's a parking space right here. I'm just going to take it. It's the most safe. Versus I'm going straight to the front door of the building, and I'm going to work my way out. I'm going to not park any further away than I have to get a good space. And I feel like if anyone at the table was going to be like, I'm launching and going straight and I'm going to get the best routing I could, you didn't let me down. What's your plan here, Doug?
Well, I'm going, you know, it would be, and if my dear friend Dave Hirschman was here, he'd probably be taking the same choice.
He'd be in the seat right next to you going, how did I get here?
Or we'd do a formation flight through this.
Yeah.
Okay. A whole bunch of different things relative to my answer. So you started the conversation with thinking about the learner and what are they going to get from this, plus what do I need to do for myself in getting to Nashville? Mm-hmm. I think you all know I do trips up and down the East Coast. I fly in this stuff all the time, and my clients come to me to be exposed to this, okay? So just with that thought in mind, number one, I have to get to the client, okay? The weather's moving east. By the time I get there and come back, there might not even be weather that I can expose my client to. But if they've come to me, they're coming to be exposed to this to see how do we negotiate and work through it.
Right. So do I just want
to keep them safe, or do I want to improve their skills and their ability to negotiate with ATC? The other thing is I do not use ADS-B radar filtered down to 4 levels. I use XM with 7 levels. And I can show you screenshot after screenshot of my airplane cursor in ADS-B in the middle of red and in XM in yellow to maybe slightly orange. Might be a little bumpy, might lose some paint. Yeah, I'm going to go through this, okay? Several other things that helped me make that decision. One of the things I looked at, certainly I'm looking at the SKU-Ts, I'm looking at the capes, I'm looking at the lifting index. And there's nothing in there that shows potential for convection. Yeah, I might get some heavy rain. Yeah, I might lose a little more paint. But I'm going to get there. I'm not really worried about that. Am I worried about what the client's going to think watching my flight track to get there? Maybe they're learning that this can be done. Okay. It also has to do with understanding your client. Mm-hmm. You know, is your client a risk taker? Well, you don't necessarily. You might want to scare them. Okay. Mm-hmm. And sometimes even coming back through it will be the thing that scares them to say, I never want to do that again.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been in these situations with many clients. So
that last bit there, I've been with situations the client's gone through with you and it's like, I never want to do that again. That's a valuable thing to expose your client to, you think?
Absolutely. I mean, the other day we're talking about circling approaches. I'll do circling approaches down to minimums for the sole purpose of saying, once we land, would you ever really want to do that for real?
Again, there's this two things going on here, and I think it's a very real world kind of situation. You know, we have places we want to go in our airplanes, and then we have how are we going to actually pull this off to get there. Let's put the people aside again for a moment, just go back to the weather a little bit to focus on that. We don't have our regular meteorologists at the table for this one. We don't have JP Dice or Scott Denstedt, but Elaine, you had talked to JP about this weather and whether it was something to go through. You also have a fair amount of Cirrus time as well. Would you, looking at Doug's choice of running through the heaviest middle of this, do you think he's nuts for going through it, or is it just like, yeah, that's more than I would really want to do?
Well, first of all, I am not flying my airplane. I'm flying a client's new-to-him airplane, so showing up in Nashville with the paint stripped off is probably not going to make that client very happy, even though, you know, I have a cool weather story to tell, so maybe that's going a little far in terms of a teachable. Maybe some other time I'll say, hey, you want to try stripping some paint off the airplane, there's some weather up ahead. And again, maybe for a later day. And so I would certainly keep that in mind in terms of whose airplane am I flying? What am I flying? If it's already missing some paint and it's in rough shape and they're going to go to the paint shop next week, you know, maybe I think about it a little differently, but I think that it is still not the safest option and probably not the best option for somebody who, again, in this pilot situation, doesn't have a lot of time in this make and model, and is also picking up a fairly new to them client. And so that would not be the best way to break the ice. And I would still stick with my plan of being moderately conservative to say, hey, I made it through the weather, but I did take the safer route. The conversation with JP was very helpful because it was kind of taking what I thought was the case, like fairly safe, the convection would be that kind of low level that wouldn't be too terrible, and just kind of confirming with him into to the point where I'd make that decision for option four. And he took a look at the charts and said, yeah, to me that looks like you've got very low odds of that turning into anything nasty, also based on the stability on the SKU-T charts. Unless you wait too long, it shouldn't turn bad on you. So I felt that there was some comfort level there. I also took in mind, though, that, again, green can turn into red. Red can turn into green. I mentioned that recent flight I took where, it was green up on the next red, but when I landed, I'd realized, if I'd actually gone through that an hour later, I might have actually hit some pretty bad turbulence or convection. So again, what we see may not be what we actually get in terms of forecasted weather. But again, the conversation pre-flight made it look fairly comfortable to proceed with this.
Right. You had been talking about this flight where you came in, landed, it was all green, and you got out of the airplane and heard thunder, which obviously is convection. And that's got to be quite the, like, wow, I just landed underneath that. I had no idea that was there, right? What would you say, Tom, since you had talked about the 4/5, about making that turn, to Doug's comment that it doesn't matter what you're seeing here at pre-flight, really. As you get up in the air, everything's going to have moved. How are you evaluating what looks good off the right wing? What are you specifically looking at, given the tools that are available, or asking from ATC? What's that process like from an experienced pilot picking their way through?
Right. Well, of course, we're using the radar, but understanding that the radar we're looking at, of course, is not current. It's, minutes to quite a few minutes old. And so recognizing that, as we've said many times, it's a strategic tool, not a tactical one. And so, but looking, basically watching what's happening using the animation feature on 4Flight, for example, to watch how fast it's moving and what's the contouring doing. And so to get a sense of what's building and what may not be building, I use ATC all the time for weather requests and asking them for input on the decisions I'm making regarding routing and what it is that they're seeing and what other pilots, like asking for PI reps, what's the ride like, that sort of thing. So those are all tools that I think are important for somebody making these kind of decisions. And the other thing is, I think that I've seen some pilots, particularly new instrument pilots, who don't realize how much you can negotiate with ATC. It's like ATC says, this is the route that I'm given, and so that's what I got to do. It's like, no. Your pilot in command, you can make requests and negotiate with them. And sometimes they're able to be very flexible and give you a lot of latitude, but other times they can't because of other air traffic or other situations. But then you may have to make a more dramatic decision. It's like, if you can't help me there, then I'm just going to go completely different direction, which I think Bruce alluded to. We're just going to go way to the west, and we'll pick an airport over there, and we'll head that way, and we can maybe make the turn back more to the north or to the east, or maybe we're going to have to land for fuel. But it's all about, dealing, as you said, with a dynamic situation and making decisions on the fly, so to speak.
And then picking an airport and then doing a change is a totally fair and valid way of doing things. I've always had this fear that the ATC might look at that as kind of like this bait and switch. I filed over there, but I had no intention of landing over there. And you know it, and I know it. And now I'm going to ask for a change of destination. John, is that does that occur to the controller, or do you just wait till you're in a different sector so it's a completely different person? You don't have to worry about it.
Yeah, more than likely. it depends on exactly where you're doing this. If you're right over the top of Atlanta, threading your way through this weather and the downwinds for the runways, they're not going to be real happy. But if we start out to the west, like Bruce was suggesting, that's a good plan to get a route. You're probably talking to either a low-level approach control or a center sector or something who's in a much better position to accommodate that kind of request. They're still going to ask you for the reason.
Right.
But you could just say, weather, right. Change of destination, whatever. That's an old 9/11 requirement that's still hanging around now when they ask for the reason for change of destination.
Right. Right, yeah, so you shouldn't worry about that. It's not because you did something wrong. They're right, just required right. to ask for the reason. You can even volunteer that, right? Like, I'd like to change my destination. The headwinds aren't as bad as I thought they would be. I can keep going. Yeah, that sounds great. And sort of circumvent that. You know, you said something interesting about the Bravo. You know, we can get so focused, and I think this pilot was on the weather as the thing that's blocking motion, right? The one wall of the canyon. The airspace isn't even depicted here. Catherine, this is in your home area, and you mentioned you just made a flight sort of like this. Two-part question. Do you think about the airspace as a no-go area as well when you're trying to do your planning? They're not going to let me go over there. And what do you look for when trying to thread your way safely through weather? Same as Tom. What practical, real-world flight deck tips do you have for that?
Yeah, so this weather is so common in the South that if you were completely avoiding it, you wouldn't fly April through August. It's just a fact of life in the South. So, you know, that doesn't deter me much. When I flew here a couple of days ago, it was nice because I was actually in and out of clouds through this process. So you can get a little more appreciation for, you know, the nature of the weather when you're in and out instead of just being solid IMC. One thing that I had to chuckle about with this flight path, though, is that flying around Atlanta for so many years, I laugh because I think the words that the pilot would hear are, "We have a rerouting for you, advise ready to copy." You know, every time I would fly down to Florida, my route would include Tyro, which is barely clips the southwest side of Atlanta's airspace. And you're just barely in it by probably a quarter mile or a half a mile. And I always got rerouted out to Heffen, which is way the hell to the left or to the west of the Bravo. So I really don't think that the pilot is going to get anywhere close to this, just a guess. But, you know, I learned something new. I wouldn't even have thought to, say, file to an airport out to the, say, southwest of the Bravo and then cut north. That's actually a really effective tool.
It's definitely a tool, having flown around the Northeast, that we used to use quite a bit. There's a lot of nodding on the table. I can even see nodding in the control room about, yeah, that's kind of the way it goes around here.
Right. That saves that negotiation, which I would have had with this route. I would have negotiated a route around the southwest.
But I always feel a little guilty, like I'm cheating if I do that. Bruce is shaking his head no.
I do that all the time in the Pacific Northwest for reasons. Again, I've got some local experience that I know, yeah, you're going to get this routing. You know, no matter what you file, that's what the computer's going to spit out. And I'm going here, and okay, I'll accept that. Or I will just, knowing that, I will plan a route that I know will work or keep me clear of whatever issue ATC has that I don't really understand. And then once in the air, working it out with the controllers, it'll work. But this question about the airspace is, I think, is important because it comes up again where I fly. There is a lot of complicated airspace and terrain. We got mountains, not just cumulus clouds, you know. And any of these routes, like the reason I want to go west is I really don't want to get stuck. I don't really know what this weather is going to do. I'm not as experienced with how these types of systems work this time of year and so forth. This picture scares me when I look at it. So, you know, I want to be careful. And I do not want to get in a position now where I've got weather and ATC is unable, just because they've got everybody on arrivals to Atlanta need deviations. Now I'm really stuck. So that's why I'm going to go west and then watch the weather carefully, both visually and what I'm seeing on my displays, whatever they may be, talk to ATC. And then as I can cut corners, great. And if I can't, this is the real world of GA. I land because I'm tired, I'm running low on fuel reserves, whatever. I'll now file another flight plan to go from Podunk, wherever I landed, onto Nashville.
But that Route 5, because people may be looking at those resources there, that Route 5 is taking you across an area with airmets for low-level wind shear, and it's not like that's necessarily completely in the clear. And, you know, there's some pretty widespread low ceilings and low visibility, even not where these clouds are. So this is challenging in that you don't get to see. I mean, obviously the best way to get around convective weather certainly is to keep it in sight and not get inside the clouds. This is going to be in the clouds. You are going to be IMC for a long time on this trip. And that gets us back to getting experience without getting in over one's head, which is kind of the other side of this scenario. I'm going to look back over to Doug. I would say like the average pilot looking at this weather, maybe if they weren't, you know, Catherine, who is familiar with weather in this area and knows the air, they wouldn't take it on. They just wouldn't fly in it, right? Or they would be very nervous to do so. And yet more experience reveals some of the holes in the armor, right, that you can exploit. What's the right way to gain experience without getting in over your head? Not everyone can fly all the time with a super experienced instructor who has a lot of experience in the weather or knows the area really well. And we need this. You need to be able to push your envelope a little without breaking the airplane apart.
This is very true. This is not the place for a brand new instrument instructor to take a client.
Right.
Okay. You want to be sure that if you're the client, you're the learner, that your instructor has experience with it. The other thing is, though I mentioned this, it is a constant process of reassessing. And Elaine said, well, you've got to have plan B and plan C. There are times we get up to Z and then to double A. It's a constant reassessment. It's a constant working with ATC. I remember trying to get into Hickory, North Carolina once in a day like this, talking to Atlanta Center. Stuff was popping. Atlanta Center couldn't keep up with it. I couldn't keep up with it. And we were on the base leg for Hickory when we said, this is not working, and turned around and went about 50 miles south.
Wow.
I know that my client learned that that's nothing he'll ever want to do. Okay. As the instructor, you have to be confident in your skills, in your weather abilities, in your communication abilities. I don't take this lightly. I will admit the one thing that I did not consider was the airspace. I don't know this airspace, and I didn't think about the fact that those negotiating skills that I think I have pretty well are going to be, sorry, Charlie, or, you know, no tuna today, whatever it is, you know, it might not work. And I had not considered that, and makes me do a little reassessment.
Bruce. I want to talk about experience just a little bit more, though, here. Part of this setup is, again, this pilot who's flying to the client, very experienced pilot,
right,
but not in GA single-engine airplanes with the limited performance and so forth. And we need to be very careful. We all admire, you know, airline pilots and military pilots for their experience. But, you know, I don't know anything about flying floats. Mm-hmm. You know, I've got a lot of experience, but I'm not going to, you know, push that envelope. And it's also sometimes this mistake we make of thinking, well, just because you're an experienced airline or military pilot, you know how to do this type of operation.
Right.
And you need to make sure that you're properly assessing that as part of your overall plan and your mitigation strategies.
Yeah, it makes me think of a Navy pilot friend of mine, P-3 Orions, carrier qualified, the Viking and everything. And we climbed into a 172 because I was checking him out in it. And he says, so remind me again what this red knob is for.
Well, exactly. I mean, the analogy is, you know, I'm vaguely familiar with airplanes. I've flown Citations occasionally, you know, that kind of thing. But I'm not qualified to fly them. It would be as big a leap for me to do that as sometimes it is for somebody who's flying corporate jets to jump back down into my airplane and go fly.
To an airline pilot, single pilot IFR is an emergency situation.
Yeah, before takeoff. I'd like to declare an emergency now.
Let's cut through the paperwork.
Yeah.
Tom.
Yeah, I just wanted to stress again, the idea of flying with somebody like Doug, you know, finding a mentor, somebody who's experienced this kind of weather, because that's how you learn. That's how you expand safely, is by, you know, even if maybe it's not even riding with somebody, but it's somebody you can call who is experienced and can help you talk through some of the things that we're talking about here as you're planning a flight. But ideally, it is flying with somebody who has a lot of experience who can go, you know, maybe it's not one or two, but it's you know, three and a half or something that takes you a little closer to some of the worst weather to get experience in flying in that. If nothing else, to recognize what that looks and feels like and know that you don't want to go there. So that's just important and something, again, I think that a lot of people are really afraid to take on even pretty benign weather because they just don't have the experience. They don't have somebody who they can count on to sort of help them understand, you know, the difference between flying in green and yellow, for example.
Bruce.
Let me put in a plug for one of my favorite aviation books, which is not often on most people's top 10 list, and it's Inside the Sky. And it's by Stick and Rudder's son, you know, and it's one of, there's at least one chapter in there where he deliberately, he's an experienced GA pilot, where he deliberately goes out, he said, looks at the weather map and says, there's bad weather. Bob, jump in, let's go see what this is like. Now, I'm not recommending that, but it's an interesting read.
You're recommending the book by somebody who already did that for you.
Exactly. It's an interesting read. He has chapters about a variety of things, but this is specifically one of them. Let's go fly in some really bad weather and see what that's like.
I got to say, when I read that, I thought, maybe I am sane.
Well, you've at least got good company, right? You know, Elaine, I want to go back to one thing that you said in your evaluation of this that I'd like to hear you expand on a little bit because it's on this topic. You said that having lots of flight experience doesn't mean taking more risks. It means getting really good at adjusting personal minimums up and down to fit the situation. Can you give us an example of that or exactly what you mean by that? Because I think a lot of people would challenge that, saying the whole point of a personal minimum is you don't change it lightly, certainly on a situation-by-situation basis. What did you mean?
That's one of the myths with either personal minimums or high-time pilots. A lot of people, especially those starting out or getting their first ratings, assume that, like we had talked about, a high-time military jet pilot, oh, it's going to be perfect for this airplane, you know, incredibly experienced, knows a lot. And that can actually be the opposite, where that pilot who is, again, new to stepping back down to single pilot GA is going to have to take a real hard look in the mirror about, okay, I need to reset personal minimums for this aircraft, for this type of situation. And what I mean about adjusting personal minimums, it's not just, you know, up and down on the fly or making these kinds of snap decisions. It's actually assessing them for every situation. So we all have what I would call, I call them baseline personal minimums when we do seminars and talk about, you know, it's really good to establish minimums for ceiling, visibility, wind and all that. But those are going to be organic. Those are going to be, okay, I'm going to adjust this a little bit for today because I'm flying an aircraft that I hadn't flown in a couple months. So I'm going to adjust that back down for crosswind components and things like that. So it's actually just a baseline to assess, am I going to be up and down from that baseline because either hadn't flown in that aircraft in a while or I'm taking somebody up as a passenger in the aircraft. I'm going to adjust those personal minimums, and it has nothing to do with my ability to land that airplane in that crosswind or in that gusty situation. It's going to be, well, this is my minimum for this situation, taking up a passenger. I don't want to cause any problems or air sickness or nervousness. So I'm going to say, well, if the wind's over 15 knots today, we probably will reschedule the flight. And so I think it's actually opening yourself up to that reflection every time you're going to go flying. It's got to fit the situation.
Doug.
I agree 100% with you, Elaine. There's a tool that I always ask applicants in a practical test, you know, well, yeah, personal minimums are great, but are they static or not? And they change. Do you have any tools that you're aware of that you can use to objectify your decisions? And I want to hear them say, yes, a flight risk assessment tool. And there are numerous of them out there. And that takes in the entire scope of the PAVE checklist, all the elements that go into it. And it's constantly changing. It is not static. It is constantly dynamic.
Yeah, and there's a lot of nods around the table. I've got one more examiner at the table. I wanted to ask you, Catherine, before we wrap up, how would you feel about an applicant for an instrument rating who basically gave you Elaine's definition of personal minimums, because that's something you're going to assess, that they go up and down with the situation? What would be your response to that?
I'd be happy with that. You know, every once in a while, I see applicants who have not even assembled a set of personal minimums. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's a flight instructor who hasn't done his or her job, and it's a candidate that really needs to, get busy. What Elaine is talking about is not only assembling a set of personal minimums, but fine-tuning it. And I would applaud that.
You know, this scenario, it almost feels like the poster child for the old saw that, like, good decisions come from experience and experience comes from bad decisions. And I'm not sure I have good advice on how to escape that loop. You scare yourself sometimes. But one thing from this scenario to take away might be separating the pressure of making a flight, got to get there and back, from the logistics of making the flight. My route is complicated by the weather. And see if either one individually would still be a go. And then if it is, and you launch, keeping track of where your nearest exit is throughout the flight.